Hi, I'm Andrew Keith Walker.
Hello, I'm Barbara Reed.
Hi, I'm Laura Rodriguez.
Hi, I'm John Kernan.
Hi, I'm Nick Bruce.
And this is the number one regulatory reporting podcast in the EU, the UK, and around the world. So join us as we go behind the scenes and under the hood to look at the big issues and news stories, companies and personalities who are shaping the world of RegTech, FinTech and trade repositories. Welcome to the RegisTR Roundup. And remember, this podcast is brought to you by RegisTR, which is a six company and features members of the RegisTR team and special guests offering their personal opinions, not the opinions of RegisTR as an organization. There is no representation made as to the accuracy or completeness of information in this podcast, nor should you take it as legal, tax, or other professional advice. And welcome back to this episode 2 of season 9 of the RegisTR Roundup. Yes, we are back. It is season 9. And, you know, we thought we'd only have a few episodes in us in 2020. And here we are, over 70 episodes in, and we are back. And we have a very special show because, of course, joining us are my regular co-hosts, Mr. Nicholas Bruce, Head of Business Development. Hey, Nick.
Hello, Andrew. Good to be back again.
It's good to have you back. And also, back is the CEO of RegisTR in the UK, the man who, you know, maybe in Devonshire, but he's never square. It is, of course, John Kernan. John, good to have you back.
Thanks, Andrew. It's great to be back. Oh, hi, listeners.
And also, going back over 70 episodes, it's one of our very, very first guests. In fact, I think it's our second guest ever. In the show, Mr. Tim Hartley is back. Now, Tim, of course, you may remember back in the day, was a leading analyst at Duff & Phelps, and he has moved to various different roles since then. But he is now the director of EMEA reporting at Kaizen, one of our partners there, and also one of our very early guests in the series. So, Tim, it's like you've finally come home. The prodigal son has returned to the podcast. Welcome back, Tim Hartley.
Thank you, Andrew and team. Yeah, I feel very welcome and feel very safe.
Good, good. Well, I mean, I wouldn't feel too safe because we're changing up the format, for season 9. We have got an AI challenge here, which is we've created an AI version of Tim Hartley, and we're going to test and see which one of you knows your stuff the best. So you're going to like that when it comes later. Listen out for the special ChatGTP section. It starts like this. And hopefully ends like this. And not like this. But before we get to that, we actually have some serious business to attend to. And I want to just fire this question over to John. John, how do you feel about Manchester City's performance recently in the Premier League?
I don't know. It's Hobson's choice for me. You know, either Arsenal win the league or Man City win the league, and I take no pleasure in either of those scenarios. So,
okay.
Thanks for asking.
Do you take any pleasure in Nick's obvious distress that Man City is going to win it?
Honestly, I don't, because I just, you know, Man City to win it again, what's that, 5 times out of 6? It's just tedious, isn't it?
I mean, it just sounds like you're rubbing it in now on Nick over the fact that Arsenal haven't won it that many times.
Andrew, can I just jump in here and say, look, I feel in the pain with John. We had St. Totteridge Day, which obviously is something that comes along normally every year, normally by mid-December, which is the date when obviously Spurs can't catch Arsenal mathematically in the league. And we had that and I felt nothing because I was just so disappointed that we'd gone and thrown it against Manchester City. So I'm kind of in that same, is it funk is the right word, where I just said I'm on the beach now with my beach ball, you know, as an Arsenal fan, the season's done and dusted, that's it. I'm just looking forward to next season when we become invincible again and we go on and we win the league. And I don't believe a word of that, to be perfectly honest. But hey, you can dream.
I am looking forward to you winning the league very much. But looking forwards is a big deal for the show. And Tim, this is where we kick off with the serious stuff with you, because we're less than a year out now. EMEA Refit is going to be in full effect a year from now. So let's look at the state of play. And let's start with the data quality report that came out from ESMA regarding the big picture outlook There's, you know, some interesting things that have been thrown up by that. But what's your view of the big picture? EMEA readiness, EMEA quality, is it there? Are people going to hit their targets for next year?
Interesting. There's definitely still a lot of work to be done. Firms are more keen than ever to make sure that data quality is there. And I think I haven't seen that across multiple jurisdictions in as much enthusiasm as I do today. And that's a really encouraging thing. That being said, there's still a lot of work to do. The data quality reports that we've had in the last few years have picked up on some of those items that we're going to talk a bit more about, I think, today. So collateral valuations, missing reports or late reports and things like that. Whereas the report for this year gives a bit of a change of direction in that previously they've been kind of tellings off, if you like, from ESMA. But the data quality report that's been released recently gives more of an outlook on what practices the regulators are using or going to use, and also what kind of proactive actions they're going to employ to try and help improve data quality on a systematic and proactive basis, such as they've got different data quality indicators. So they've got processes and ways of targeting bad data systematically across the different national competent authorities and across the different European entities that have to report their data. And also, there are big seismic changes to EMEA reporting, such as the EMEA refit that we mentioned earlier on. One of the main aims with that EMEA refit is to make sure that data quality is as high as it can be. So I think there's still a lot of work to be done, but the enthusiasm from firms is still is really, really high at the moment. And firms are really trying hard to get it right, even if they haven't done so in the past.
And I mean, talking of those sort of various sort of nitty-gritty issues that we need to get into, and also the cost to market participants, Tim, something you've talked about, something that was raised in the data quality report, was the issue of valuations and collateral submissions and keeping that data timely and up to date. Now, of course, in the past, this may have been less of an issue, but we've been through times of, you know, unprecedented volatility, that we know that buy-side firms have been repoing at a much greater volume than before so that they can hit their sort of UMR requirements and their mark-to-markets and variations. So, I mean, how do you keep on top of... That's almost a real-time data issue, and it's at a huge volume, surely. So, I mean, how do you get the data quality of something like that up?
The way that you get there as a firm is you have to make sure you have a reasonable understanding of what the regulations are, which isn't particularly easy. There's a lot of interpretation around some of the different reporting regimes. And so that's something that firms have to get their head around, number one. And then you also have to have checks and balances in place to make sure that what you want to achieve is actually happening. You are doing your, for example, valuation and collateral reports within a T+1 timeframe and doing it for every trade or position that's open. You are making sure that the valuations match actually what you've is going on in the marketplace for that particular trade that you've executed, that you have open, and the collateral matches the collateral that's out there for those positions as well. All those things sound very simple, but when you get down to the detail, can be quite tough. And so at least having reconciliations and assurance services in place to make sure that you're reporting something and that it's in line with what you're expecting, that can cater for a lot of the sins that we see out there. But it's a lot of work to get done, and it's almost just as important as reporting the original trade, because the trade will give the economic details of the submission itself. And then you want to see those changes in what, for example, for those regimes that are looking for exposure or looking to measure exposure, you want to see what the collateral valuations are, so the regulator has a good idea of at any point in time what the exposure of markets and different firms have, for example, with regards to derivative products.
And on top of that, there has been this discovery, and this is something I know you've written about on the Kaizen blog, which is very, very informative, by the way. If you haven't been there and checked it out and listening to the show, do go and keep an eye on it, because you've got some of the top experts in the world commenting on these issues. There is this problem, isn't there, that NCAs haven't necessarily been getting the same data as ESMA about the same trades and the same sort of issues when it comes to reporting. Now, of course, this is a mess, not malice, but it does seem like there's some fairly fundamental challenges if even different regulatory authorities are receiving different information.
Yeah, absolutely right. I think one thing that perhaps doesn't get talked about all that much, and I haven't written about it for a long time, is the fact that not all of the national competent authorities are signed up to receive regulatory reporting where they're mandated to. Now, I think, to be fair, most of what I'll call the important NCAs are signed up, and they are in a good spot, which means that firms' data is getting scrutinized. But first of all, NCAs do have to get signed up to all of the data. And secondly, I think it's very tough on trade repositories because when we first started, for example, EMEA reporting, not all the national competent authorities had to agree in the way that data would be provided. And so there are multiple different ways of providing data. We have had the TRACE system implemented in reasonably recent years, which gives a bit more uniformity to how data is transferred. But there are still legacy systems. There are still NCAs that have data being transferred in different ways. And as we have different processes, that can lead to discrepancies. So I think the comments there, Andrew, are fair. They do target a bit of blame on the TRs, which I'll let our TR speak in a second. But I think it's not always the TR's fault because there's multiple processes in place, whereas it would have been more strict and far less flexible. But there is an argument to say that the NCAs, A, should have been signed up without any choice, and B, should have been signed up the same way. For example, SFTP files being sent across them or something along those sort of lines when EMEA reporting first started, or at least changing that a year down the line to make sure they're all signed up in the same way. Does that sound fair, John?
I think that sounds fair. I mean, the amount of output from the TR, I forget the exact figure, but I know that it's more than a multiple of 10. So in terms of the data we ingest from our participants versus the amount of data we're sending out to the NCAs and supervisory regulators, it's enormous, absolutely enormous.
Yeah, I know. I was just going to say, as someone who's sort of come into it relatively late, I keep saying that, probably 3 years in, I can't anymore. But, you know, but not being there at the start of the EMEA reporting regime, unlike, you know, Tim, John, I know you were, one of my first observations was it wasn't prescribed in terms of the information everyone was receiving, the format of that information as well. And I do think that that's certainly something that's been recognised, and one of the changes that you see within ReFit is it's to close those gaps, it's to get that consistency of the information. And it does seem crazy it wasn't there from day one, but I think it's just been part of that learning curve when trying to establish something, you know, from the ground up. There's a lot of stages to learning, and you can't implement things overnight because of the impact it has downstream on market participants. But I think we're getting there, which is the good thing.
Well, we are coming now, obviously, to the exciting Brexit portion of the show. Yes, you thought it was over, but we still have more to talk about. And Tim, back to you, because the FCA posted their final EMEA refit validation rules last week, well, a couple of weeks ago now. I mean, how aligned are they to the EU? Is everything looking like a sigh of relief on this side of the channel?
Yes, it is. The final validation rules from the FCA are very similar to those from ESMA. And so firms will find relief in that, there's not a lot of difference between the two. Any differences that are there are quite subtle. And I think, to be fair, you'd be unlucky as a firm to get caught out by those subtle changes. I think, Andrew, we'll see more divergence as time goes on from the FCA, because the FCA, even though they look after the United Kingdom, whereas obviously ESMA have regulatory oversight for many, many countries. I think the FCA do punch above their weight in terms of influence for EMEA reporting. And so the FCA will have their own ideas and things that they want to implement. So I think we'll see that divergence increase. But for the time being, for EMEA refit implementation, they're very similar. And there are only some really subtle differences around how some of the details are set up. that you'd be unlucky to get caught out by it. So I think that's a positive move by the FCA for reporting firms.
Well, I was just going to say, one of the other, and this is kind of tied into the previous question, really. So we have obviously standard reporting on trading activity that we send to the competent and supervisory authorities. But we've also something called periodic reporting, which is an enormous amount of data and information spanning all aspects of the TR operation. Some of that has to be provided annually, some biannually. It's a huge exercise. And what we're seeing at the moment with the FCA is a consultation with a view to streamline that process. And for some of the information that we're providing on a habitual basis, it looks like they're now saying, you know what, report it once and then only ever report it again to us if there's a material change. So you just kind of report the delta rather than a, you know, standard submission. So that's another kind of interesting angle that the FCA really strike me as being very keen to streamline things, to reduce operational burden where it makes sense to do so. And I think actually, if I'm not mistaken, there may be a consultation on the periodic reporting following in the European Union under ESMA as well now.
We are living in a world that is moving very fast, and we're moving rapidly into the future. And that means it brings us to our special AI segment. I love this new mixing desk. I got to say that. Okay, so here we go. Now, what we did to explain how this works, Tim, we went to ChatGPT and we asked it to pretend it was you and answer this question, which is, how do you see data quality evolving in the regulatory reporting landscape in 2023? Okay, so I'd like to hear your answer, and then I will read what ChatGPT said.
So data quality should improve in 2023, primarily as the way to report, specifically under EMIR, changes, becomes a little more prescriptive, but also the guidelines and level three documentation from regulators increases, and so explanation around what have previously been grey areas become a little bit more clarified, and firms get a bit more information and a bit more guidance on how things should be reported. Also, for example, in EMIR refit, one of the things is that we're aligning EMIR with the critical data elements guidance. And so again, it gives a bit more structure and a bit more uniformity as to how things should be reported. And so I'm hoping that in means that data quality would improve, and I'm hoping that ChatGPT is not going to show me up and give me a better answer.
Okay, well, you know what? We'll have to put that to the vote. So Nick and John, be ready. What our AI version of Tim Hartley said was, I believe that data quality will continue to be a key focus for regulators in 2023 and beyond. A bit of filler there, I think, let's be honest. As the volume of data being reported continues to grow, it will become increasingly important for firms to ensure the data they report is accurate, complete, and consistent. They require firms to invest in robust data management systems and processes, as well as to collaborate more closely with their counterparties to ensure that the data they report is consistent across the industry. Ultimately, the goal is to improve the quality of the data reported to trade repositories, which in turn will improve the regulator's ability to monitor and manage the risks in the derivatives market. That's what AI Tim said. It's time to vote. Ooh. Who did it best?
AI Tim. Definitely, there was a lot of buzzwords in there. You know, it was definitely on message. Very generic. Personally, I think what that shows is you just can't replace the original Tim. You know, the original Tim Hartley, he's one of a kind. And I think that's really what this has shown up. However, I am 100% certain that the AI Nick will be far superior than me.
And John?
I've got to be honest, I preferred the second one.
I knew you'd say that.
Tim was very sympathetic towards trade repositories as well. And then that probably won me over.
Okay, fine. Well, I guess that leaves the casting vote with me. And I'm going to go with the original Hartley. I think original and best. You know, you can't beat the original Tim Hartley with his breakfast bap and, you know, his sage-like wisdom. I think he'd be the one. Which one would you want to go to the pub with? It would be Hartley one, wouldn't it? It'd be the original.
But isn't the AI one a bit like... a bit like Tim Hartley's greatest hits. You know, it's like if you're watching YouTube, your football team's just signed a new footballer and you watch his YouTube reel and he looks like the new Maradona.
It's true. I mean, it's on message and it's clearly picked up some of Tim's best quotes, but it lacks that. It doesn't have the Timness that we expect from our living human guests. So I'm going to say that is a win.
What though? Andrew, you said something though critical there. You said you'd rather go to the pub with the original Hartley. But I'm just thinking the AI Hartley might get around him. So, I'm not convinced.
Good luck finding a bar, Nick, that takes Bitcoin. Yeah.
Humans, you're still winning the series.
I'm a bit relieved that the ChatGPT was full of Timisms, if you will, but couldn't quite string it together. I was a little bit nervous it was going to completely outdo me. Yeah?
I think what's really interesting is that it's obviously digested an awful lot of what you've said. And it feels like a lot of the headlines, because often you're quoted with a headline or a soundbite. Yeah. Sort of, it's put all of those together. Yeah. But it's the juicy stuff we want, which does lead us, sadly, to a proper question. And that is the remaining challenges for Amir. Okay, we know that market participants aren't necessarily all as ready as they should be. There are some challenges. Now, we've talked about UPIs in the show, so the identifier codes, which seems like it should be the same kind of issue as the UTIs that, you know, were getting everyone nervous before SFTR kicked in, and then it was fine. There's some confusion over, you know, definitions in Amir and precise reporting obligations. Of course, there's more people in scope. There's also more activities and clearing and this sort of stuff. What are the big challenges you think still remaining going forwards? And one of the ones that the chat GPT actually did bring up was confusion over alternative investment funds and their status reporting-wise in the UK after Brexit. So what are, for you, those issues that are still outstanding that the market participants haven't necessarily grappled with yet?
Yeah, I think the chat GPT question around AIFs, that actually is still a good question and something that firms do get confused by, meaning for mere reporting, if you're a non-UK or non-EU AIF, because you're managed by an AIFM, so a management firm, according to Article 2 of the what was original Amir, the management firm gets listed under the counterparty definition, which is Article 2, and therefore the management firm is on the hook for reporting, albeit the AIF is the reporting counterparty, which means that, for example, funds in the Cayman Islands that are nowhere near the UK, sadly, and are nowhere near the EU, get caught for Amir reporting. Because the management company, let's say in this case, are based in London. And so the London-based firm has to make sure that reporting is taking place. Now, Andrew, for SFTR, there was a clever letter which came out. I forget whether it's from the European Union or from the European Commission. One of them said that, no, under SFTR, we don't want non-EU AIFs to report. Whereas under Amir, we still have that in place. And so that is still a source of confusion today for firms. And if we step back a second from mere reporting, it doesn't really make sense that they want to have that reporting within, let's say, the UK's in mere reporting. It doesn't really add any value to the exposure that's there. Some may say that if you want to see a complete picture, you want to have all those funds included as well. But we'll leave that for our listeners to decide on that. Other areas of concern are still important. So other challenges. Things like CFI codes, so classification of financial instruments. I see a lot of firms that struggle with those CFI codes to put the right information in there. Or, for example, they'll put the first two figures only of and then put XXXX for all the other component parts. UTI is not too tough today, but under REFIT, Andrew, the waterfall for how you create and disseminate a UTI changes. And I think that will make things more inflexible for firms. And so I think that's a challenge. And then for UPIs that you mentioned there, for unique product identifiers, for Amir, we're lucky that the UPIs will go live with the CFTC first, CFTC reporting first. And this process is still being baked, it's fair to say. and firms don't totally understand how that UPI process will work. The idea is that you'll get your unique product identifier from one source, which will be Anna DSB. And so we're hoping that will help remove any creative license around what the UPI will be, meaning that it'll be much more strict on the UPI that's used, so the regulators have a better view of what the product is that's been reported. But there is still, there's more questions than there are solutions at the moment from firms that are out there on how that process will work. But again, if we step back for a second, Andrew, there's a lot of things that firms, for example, Kaizen, they're using their accuracy testing with us to try and work out what issues they've got, if any, to try and get those issues remediated well before EMIR refit goes live. Because, for example, with the number of fields going up from 129 to 203 fields, and the majority of those fields changing, a problem that you have for outstanding data today becomes exponentially bigger for a much larger volume of fields to be reported. And so firms are scrambling to try and make sure they understand any issues that they've got, understand what their remediation process is, and then to get those changes done with the prioritization of everything else that they're doing as a firm. Because obviously reporting is not the only thing they do. There'll be, obviously, there'll be trading or whatever else other services they provide. And so this will be a part of that. And I think that's the key challenge is, number one, time. And also, I think sometimes it's fair to say for both trade repositories and firms, the regulators forget that reporting is not the only thing these firms do. There's a lot of other things. Some firms have teams to help with this. Other firms don't. But there's a lot of work to do, and firms are struggling to get hold of that in time to remediate those issues before EMIR refit goes live.
Well, that does lead us actually to our sort of final question, I guess, as we start to tie these threads together, which is about how the landscape is affecting your product development there at Kaizen. You've got your refit toolkit. Are you going to be, you know, making more investments in sort of the cloud-based tech and obviously the reporting shield and various sort of product lines you've got? And also, you've recently acquired London Reporting House and Red Deer, so it feels like there's a lot happening to try and address those gaps in the sort of the needs that, you know, market participants are letting you know they have and the tools you've got. So tell us more about that. I mean, what's your outlook at Kaizen? What's the strategy for EMIR product development moving forwards?
Yeah, there's definitely a lot going on. And we at the moment, we feel firms are in a tough spot in for the data and management of data, whatever that be for. There's more demands on that than we've ever seen before. And so the product development that we have is trying to reflect kind of our growth and ambition to make compliance easier for firms and to help firms kind of navigate the complexities of regulations out there, because we've mentioned half a dozen in the last 30 seconds that are really tough to get hold of. And so, for example, the acquisition of Red Deer was key for us for market abuse and surveillance. Our investment in London Reporting House, again, for what are new products to the industry, is absolutely key to help with that. And the same, for example, with our single rule book offering that we have. And kind of the EMIR refit toolkit that you mentioned right at the start there, Andrew, that's quite a good example of the changing landscape, in that previously we've had, for our report shield, we've had award-winning assurance testing and reconciliation testing. But we wanted to make sure that firms had something that was easy and approachable and help them in more ways than just the assurance testing. So, for example, the toolkit, EMIR refit toolkit, looks at the training that firms need to have to get used to the actual regulations itself. It has a single rulebook module so that you can link all of the different level 1, 2, and 3 texts. So, for example, the RTS and the guidance, you can link those all together to see where things are mentioned and what you need to pay attention to when you're looking at the notional field, when you're looking at what this other particular aspect is. And then we also have our validation checks, which is something we've not spoken a bit about today, of validations for EMIR reporting. And then also, once you've met those validation checks, have you been able to make sure that what you've reported, was it still accurate? So have you fallen into the trap of being valid but wrong? And so we have testing to cover the validation checks and for that valid and wrong accuracy testing scenario. So that we bring those together as a toolkit so that it's easy for firms to approach it all at once, rather than just saying, hey, here's one aspect, off you go.
Now, that's a really interesting point you're going to raise there. I've got to say, accuracy and validation being two different sort of targets to hit, that's an interesting perspective. I don't think we've talked about that before. I mean, Nick, is that something that you find is, you know, a challenge out there for market participants, that they might get their reporting working, but it's not necessarily getting their reporting right?
Yeah, I mean, it is something that comes up more and more often, I would say, now when we talk about data quality, because, I mean, when you sit as a TR, ultimately, we follow the validation rules that are prescribed to us via either the FCA, via ESMA, and just because a client is reporting in line with those validation or that validation criteria, it doesn't actually mean that the content of the messages is 100% correct. And so that is the next step. You've got, you know, certainly ESMA have been talking about the new tools that they have on their side. And it's something that we discussed in the last podcast. So they're getting more granularity around what's being reported. They can actually look at the detail. Or they can scrutinize the detail better. And that is really the next step now, is everyone needs to understand the quality of what they're reporting. It's no good just to tick the box to say, yes, we've reported and it's been accepted. It's now the next level. And I think that's absolutely critical.
Okay, great. Now, sadly, on that very useful and sage-like advice, that's us coming to the end of our time here on this week's roundup, which of course means we have to come to our final question. And that is something that Tim, as a man who changed my life with breakfast baps back in the day, and now I'm still trying to lose the weight, I'm going to say we're talking about healthy tips, because of course everyone is back in circulation now. We're back out traveling again. We're holding events. We're going to conferences. A lot of guests like yourself, Tim, obviously, are going to be speaking in public. And so we want to get your professional conference goer tips. How do you keep the weight off and slim back into that suit that fitted before the lockdown? How do you do that and yet manage to keep eating the tiny little high-calorie canapes and the little glasses of fizzy wine? What's your advice?
So I think my answer there is kind of twofold. In number one, I've always struggled to eat and talk at the same time, and you get the most value from our conferences, for example, from talking to individuals and gaining their opinion and insights into the marketplace. And so I'm one of my secrets that I'll give away here is that I'll make sure I've eaten before I go to the conference. Number one, because I just can't handle eating and talking at the same time. But also, I'm going to pretend that I'm regulating the food that I eat prior to going to that conference. Therefore, I'm not tempted by any of the titillations that are on offer at the different conferences. I think I'll also, Andrew, I'm going to add a little bit onto the end of that to say that whilst we're going back to conferences and go back to the office and things like that, I think a key message for a healthy lifestyle is that interaction with other people and going back into the office, especially where some people are, many firms are looking at a hybrid working environment, let's say 3 days at home, 2 days in the office. Make sure that when you're in the office, you are liaising with people, you're making the most of your time together. Even if it's just moaning about someone, it's a healthy thing to do. I think that we've got away with, or at least have been reduced over the last couple of years, to come back to that, have in-person conversation, in person, back and forth, dialect on different subjects, keeps you mentally healthy as well as the physical healthiness with food and treats.
On that note, all that remains is for us to give a huge virtual studio crew thanks to the director of EMEA Reporting at our partner Kaizen. It is, of course, Mr. Tim Hartley. Tim, thanks very much.
Great stuff. Thanks for having me on.
It's been great having you back. And also, of course, huge thanks having back my co-host here in no particular order, starting with the man who used to put the canary in the wharf and now puts the wharf into Devonshire Square. It is, of course, Mr. John Kynan. John, thank you very much.
Thanks, Andrew. And great to see you as usual, Tim.
And also, huge thanks to the voice of reason himself, the head of business development for Register CR, both here and there in the EU, Mr. Nick Bruce. Nick, thank you.
No, thank you, Andrew. And I'm looking forward to that pint with Tim and AI Tim in the next couple of months.
And in the meantime, from all of us here in the virtual studio, from me, Andrew Keith Walker, we hope you have a good week. And we'll see you in a couple of weeks. In the meantime, do join us on our LinkedIn page. That is linkedin.com/company/regis-tr, where you can network with Tim Hartley and with Nick Bruce and with John Kernan and with me if you want to. And by all means, send me your healthy lifestyle tips. I desperately need them more than the other three. And in the meantime, it's goodbye from us and everyone here at the Six Group. Bye-bye.